The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Over the weekend, Ukraine captured two North Korean soldiers fighting for Russia and said it's willing to hand them over in a prisoner exchange. On the front lines, Russia is making progress in eastern Ukraine. So we're going to get the latest now on the war and life in Ukraine from Emmanuel Shaz, Ukraine correspondent for RFI, that's Radio France Internationale and France 24, who is with me in studio. Emmanuel, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat.
You're just back here in Dublin for a visit after coming directly from Ukraine. What is life like on the ground in Kyiv?
Well, on the ground in Kyiv, you can have a sense of relative normalcy when you don't have air raid alerts, but you have air raid alerts every night. So you will hear the sirens, then you will hear the work of air defense, you will hear drones passing by, and you also have missiles that are being thrown at the capital quite regularly. So it's a very strange feeling of feeling that, having this danger looming over you all the time. And of course, you also have electricity power cuts because of those strikes. So oftentimes, you also hear generators in the streets. So it can be normal, but also it's everything but.
What about business? What about schools, education and so on?
Well, in the capital, you will see that there are restaurants which are open. You have supermarkets, you have shops opened as well. But of course, that's the capital. It's completely different to what Ukrainians are experiencing in frontline cities where you don't have businesses working anymore. The closer you get to the frontline, even if Ukrainians are very good at keeping up with public services, for example, or post office, Post is still working to the front line, up until occupation. Russian occupation is very impressive. But of course, it's a country at war and you feel it every day in everyday life.
Now, you have been to the front line in the east. What is it like there?
Well, I've been actually just a week ago. I was on an artillery position south of Pokrovsk, which is the most embattled point of the front line right now.
And this is where the Russians were thought to be focusing their attack, although that may be changing now.
They are focusing their attacks around Pokrovsk, on the eastern sector of Pokrovsk, and also they're trying to surround it by the south. And I was on those positions with the Ukrainian army. It's very hard to see this area, which I know well because I was reporting on it over a few years. And you have a lot of civilians who are still living in Donetsk region. As of mid-December, you had 300,000 civilians still in the part that is not occupied by Russia in Donetsk region, and it is believed that around 50,000 people, civilians, are stuck on the combat zone, so where there's active combat, active shelling, and also impending Russian occupation where there are advances. And those people, you have to keep in mind that they live without electricity, without heating, without water, running water, and on top of that, they live with the everyday danger of being bombed in their own homes.
What is the mood like on the front line with the forces on the one hand and on any civilians you came across who are close to the action?
Well, with the forces, they holding the position. We have to keep in mind that from the get-go, Ukrainians knew that they were outnumbered, be it in material, be it in personnel, but they have a different way of fighting than Russians. Russians fight with numbers. For example, when they launch an assault, it's not necessarily a good strategic assault, but they would, for example, launch 10 men, 9 would die, but 1 would survive. He would wait another wave of assault and it would be the same. 10 men would be launched, would be attacking, then 1 would survive. That makes 2 and so on and so on. And they don't, like, the Russian army doesn't care about the human losses the way Ukrainian army does, simply because it is what it fights for.
Now, we know that the Russians have had to involve North Korean troops in their assaults. So it shows that they don't want to sacrifice too many young Russian men because that will create its own problems. How long do you think Russia can continue with that level of attrition?
Well, mathematically, the Russian demographics are higher than Ukrainian ones. So the longer this war lasts, the more damageable it is for Ukrainian society. Of course, for Russia as well. But Russia is bigger and has more men. Now, the involvement of North Korean troops in the Kursk region is quite interesting because this is an agreement between Pyongyang and Moscow, and up to 10,000 North Korean soldiers were sent. But if you look at what international observers numbers say, there's already 4,000 of them who have been out of combat, so either injured or dead. So it raises the question of their fighting capacities, abilities, and also they are also seemingly being used as
cannon fodder, basically.
Cannon fodder, yes, yes.
Just putting people into the meat grinder, as they used to call it in the First World War.
Exactly.
What do you make of President Zelensky's offer to trade some North Korean prisoners of war for Ukrainian prisoners of war?
Well, it's in line with what he had in mind launching the Kursk operations, the Ukrainian operations in the Russian region of Kursk, because he's often talking, President Zelensky often talks about the exchange fund to talk about the prisoners of war. The interest of Ukraine is to get back its own soldiers who live in very dire conditions in Russian prisons. They are not being fed properly. They are being tortured on a daily basis. They are also dying out of ill treatment, which is contrary to the Geneva Conventions, which are not followed by Russia. On the contrary, on the opposite side, I visited detention facilities in Ukraine where Russian prisoners are treated according to Geneva Conventions. They have access to food. They are very well fed. I saw what they eat. They have parcels from their families. They can write, they can reach out to their families, which is not the case of Ukrainian prisoners of war. And the goal of Ukraine is to get back its prisoners of war. And we see regular exchanges since the beginning of the war. In fact, nearly 4,000 prisoners of war have been returned to Ukraine. And when you hear the testimonies, it's really harrowing. The way they were treated, the way they are completely traumatized by what they've been through. And this is in complete disregard to their basic human rights.
Which means that they will not be sent back to the front lines, given the condition they're in now.
The Ukrainian prisoners of war who come back to Ukraine, some of them want to go fight back. They, obviously, it's not compulsory, but some of them do continue to fight.
Now, what are we to make of war reporting? Because, for example, today they're talking about Ukraine says it downed 60 Russian drones overnight. The Russians will make counterclaims. How is the war actually going for Ukraine? We're told that they have a very effective munitions manufacturing business, that they are well armed. Is that the case?
It is the case. Of course, during the war, we're not going to know exactly how many missiles they produce, how many drones they produce. Ukraine is very strong in drone production, and they are very innovative. We have to keep in mind that on the 24th of February 22, nobody thought that Ukraine would fight back, would resist so strongly. It was supposed to be a 3 days war, according to the Kremlin, with 3 years in, and Ukraine still hasn't given up. And I think that's what is lacking in understanding here in the West, that people don't see that even if Ukraine is outnumbered, even if it doesn't look good on the front line with the Russian advances, we have to give Ukraine its own, its own initiative. And it has agency over what it does, over what it responds, and with what it responds to the Russian invasion, because it is a war of survival for Ukrainians.
Do you think we're edging towards a deal when General Kellogg comes in as Trump's representative? He's talking about a resolution of some kind within 100 days, not 24 hours, as Donald Trump promised, but 100 days. Do you think that resolution, that it's beginning to slowly form?
I think politically, the government is trying to prepare the population to some sort of a deal. However, again, Ukrainians have been fighting for their own lives, for their own people, for their survival. And you cannot tell to people who have, most of them have lost a dear one on the front line, have lost their homes to bombing, have lost someone they loved in a bombing. You cannot tell those people that this was all for nothing and that now the ceasefire will take place, or that now the front line is frozen. And also in those negotiations, if negotiation happen, we have to keep in mind that there are 6 million Ukrainians currently living under occupation, and then do not live at peace under occupation. Their basic rights are being denied when they refuse to take Russian nationality. They don't have access to healthcare. They don't have access to education. Children are deported to Russia for re-education. We're talking not about a few children. We're talking at the very minimum about 20,000 children, with the Ukrainian government talking about up to 100,000.
Now, we know that Donald Trump is threatening to withdraw financial aid to Ukraine. I mean, we don't really know what he thinks because he varies all the time. But Europe is being much more solid in terms of commitment to helping Ukraine well into the 2027-28 and may have to replace a lot of the American aid. But Europe is not entirely unified. There are countries like Croatia, like Hungary, who would be more pro-Putin.
Absolutely. And also with the Trump's presidency upcoming, Europe will have to either step up its leadership when it comes to Ukraine, step up the equipment it's sending to Ukraine. But I'd like to point out again that Ukraine doesn't expect its allies to do what it can do itself. It also produces, it also manufactures its own weaponry. It also knows from the get-go that Ukrainian soldiers are on the front line. They are the ones risking their lives and defending the country. And I would say in those times of uncertainty, Ukraine knows very well that the equipment that is being provided could just dry up, and they are trying their utmost to produce it themselves.
How much can we know about what is really going on in Russia? I mean, I read reports that the Russian economy is in quite serious trouble. The sanctions have taken a long time to take effect. Interest rates are 21%. Businesses are complaining, maybe not directly to Putin, but to the administration, that it's very hard to do business. Their armaments manufacturing is not as they would like it to be in terms of tank manufacture and so on. I mean, is there a big bluff going on by Putin to suggest things are much better in Russia than they actually are?
I'm sure they're not great, but also what I've seen is that the Russian society has been so brainwashed for decades that I'm also not sure that people would actually at some point be so fed up that they would change the government. Of course, in Ukraine and from Ukrainian perspective, a collapse of the current Russian regime would be what ultimately could stop this war of aggression, which is actually a war that Russia is waging against Ukraine, not the opposite. However, there's a lot of uncertainty as to how the Russian population would react to any change of government. And also, if you look at the polls, and they are what they are in a country which is essentially a dictatorship, but Russian society doesn't seem to mind this war so much.
Because it doesn't really affect them.
Absolutely.
Now, the use of ATACMS missiles provided by the United States, and of course Putin has said that will up the ante and make the war much more ferocious from Russia's point of view. I mean, do you think that element where Ukraine can strike deep in the heart of Russia will change things?
I do not think so. Also, Putin has announced a lot of red lines, and they have been crossed over and over. It was the providing the Patriots, providing the Leopards. There were all those steps that have been crossed actually by Ukraine, and there was never, Putin would always say he retaliates, but ultimately this war could be over should the Kremlin want so within a very short amount of time.
But one red line is probably a real one, and that would be Ukraine joining NATO.
Well, that's what he's been saying from the start, yeah, but that's what he fears the most.
So finally, the evolution of this war, we did not think that 3 years on it would still be being waged by Russia on Ukraine. Are you optimistic that in 2025 we will see some sort of end?
Honestly, it's very hard to make any prediction in Ukraine. We really take it day by day. Of course, there's an awareness that the front line, that there are advances, Russian advances. But also when you look at those advances, it's hardly strategic. It's often Russians plundering a village, which is then reduced to complete dust. And then it doesn't really give them much of an advantage. Now, they seem to have taken Kurakove, which is quite important, the way Avdiivka, for example, was important. And that will be their first significant win in 2025. But really, in Ukraine, you take it day by day. You cannot know what tomorrow will bring.
Emmanuel Shouse, thank you very much for joining us in studio in Dublin today.
Thanks for having me.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.